The topic this morning is the science of the sacred words. So this is a very important topic. We should not get away with the impression that this topic, which is incidentally called Mantra Shastra, Shastra means science, is not necessarily limited to Hindu or Vedantic tradition. You find this tradition in all spiritual cultures, wherever human beings have looked beyond their present empirical realm for finding a meaning for life or an explanation of the world or life, this has happened, a development of Mantra Shastra. Of course, in Hindu Vedantic tradition, it has a long history. There's a huge philosophical literature, spiritual literature, which grew around this particular subject. So what is a mantra? So you find today, if you say mantra for business management, mantra for economic development, and you find many contexts in which the word is used. But the original meaning is something totally different. What is the difference between a word as a word and as a word as a mantra? Every word has a meaning, you know. That is vak artha. Vak means word. Artha means what it implies. Every thought has a corresponding language. We can't have a thought without some sort of corresponding language equivalence. Now, when we concentrate, focus on the inner implication or meaning of a word, that word expands. It reveals new meanings, new implications, new possibilities, not only new possibilities of interpretation, it accumulates new potencies. So that's why frequently we know you wait for some time for the words to sink in. When you speak, you utter a sentence in a speech, when it is followed by a pause, during the pause, the listeners will think deeply on the implication of the meaning of the sentence. So similarly, when we focus on a word, its meaning, with great concentration, then that word evolves. So far as we are concerned, the possibilities, the new potencies of that word will make the word so potent, and it accumulates a degree of sacredness and sanctity when you meditate on the meaning of the word with an intensity of concentration and a sense of sanctity and sacredness. That's important in the spiritual context. This particular process of concentrating on the meaning and the implication of the word meaning or implication of the particular word is called in Sanskrit mananam. So mananam is nothing but concentrated, focused contemplation on the inner essence of a word. That's why, to give an example, we read our own meaning into scriptures. A highly evolved, spiritually evolved person may read the Bible, may read the Bhagavad Gita or any religious scripture. He may read a higher meaning, a deeper meaning into those words. Maybe a primitive person reading the same book derives a different meaning, a different sense, because the former, the more evolved person, is able to focus or concentrate or contemplate on the inner essence of that particular word, to go deeper into the essence of the word. When you do that, in spiritual tradition, it becomes a mantra. So mantra, is the traditional definition for mantra is mananat trayate iti mantra. That's one of the many, many definitions. Sravana means what you hear. Now remember, when you listen to something on YouTube and you concentrate on the meaning of the word, it doesn't become a mantra. A number of people have gone crazy contemplating and meditating on the meaning of words they listen to on YouTube and internet. Because these words have to be transmitted by somebody who has himself, to some extent at least, realized these higher potencies and possibilities of that word. You know, when you want to light a lamp, you have to bring your lamp in contact with the other lamp. Then only the flame will be transmitted from one lamp to another. So if you want an explanation for this new phenomenon that you find all over America, mostly in California, where hundreds of people practicing pranayama, practicing meditation at midnight and going crazy, many of them come here, incidentally land up here for interviews and appointments, it is the real meaning. You listen to something on YouTube, and midnight you meditate, and you delude yourself into thinking, some you heard a divine voice, it could be delusions of reference, delusions of grandeur, or prophetic syndrome, or it could be any different kinds of delusions. On the other hand, when you get it from a real teacher, it doesn't disturb your system. Rather, it brings you a kind of inner serenity, a peace, a kind of inner completeness. You get what you call intuition. Intuition is the ability to see deeper into the nature of anything that you study or more focus on. That's called intuition. So some of these definitions are very deep. Manana trana cha mantraha, manide jnayade ishradesa anena iti mantraha. There are many, many, in fact, mantrite guptam sambhashide iti mantraha. There are many, many interesting definitions. One definition is, it is something that you get from somebody in secret. Secret doesn't imply secretiveness, what you call. You get a path, or you are introduced into a spiritual tradition which you are supposed to follow, which will take you to your own spiritual destination. It is your own. It is not public. So that's why this particular element is involved in Mantra Shastra. Well, how does it help us in our ordinary life? I already mentioned earlier that this is not anything very occult. It is not a secretive occult science. It is scientific, it is rational, and it is psychologically very, very scientific. I can give you one example. Any psychology will admit this. In one of the Upanishads, in the Isavasya Upanishad, it has got 18 mantras, 18 verses. The 17th mantra is a prayer of a dying man to his own mind. He's praying to his own mind. He's disturbed. Death is a great mystery. For a wise man, death is not something mysterious. It is not something cruel. It is not something scary. An intelligent person, a spiritually evolved person, his whole life is a very intelligent, systematic preparation to leave this body behind, not going to vacuum, but starting the journey from the next transition point. So the prayer is this, Vayu Ranilam Amrutam Athedam Bhasmantam Shariram. This prayer is very simple. Let this body be reduced to ashes. In Hindu Vedantic tradition, they used to burn the body. So the body should be burned to ashes. That's not the essence of this prayer. The next prayer is Om Kratosmara Kritam Smara Kratosmara Kritam Smara. Smara means, Om mind, please remember. The dying man is praying to his own mind. So it has become a mantra. It is frequently used in some traditions. So when a dying person is breathing his last, his relatives, well-wishers, sitting around him, will recite this mantra. The meaning of mantra is something very interesting. Oh mind, please remember. Go back through your memory roots. And then, this is the time for you to remember all the good deeds you have done, all the good words you have spoken, all the good thoughts you have thought, all the wonderful, noble things that you have gone through. So, mind, it is normally you ask the professional medical staff who professionally attend to these situations. Even the most rabid, confirmed, uncompromising atheist or agnostic who has spent whole lifetime denying God and denying everything, denying himself, will feel a kind of inner helplessness when he's confronting this uncertain but certain reality. It is uncertain because it is mysterious, but it is certain, but he has to leave this world. So there is certainty, there is also uncertainty. So people who spend a whole lifetime denying everything, questioning everything, doing everything which we should not do, indulging those things in which they are not supposed to indulge in, they come to a point, they want to remember, they want to fill their mind with good memories. So this dying man says, oh mind, now travel backward on time and try to remember all the good thoughts, all the good impressions, all the good thoughts, everything. Something that gives you a kind of sublimity of life, a kind of inner fulfillment that helps you to get this feeling when you're leaving this world. I have done something worth doing. I have thought certain things worth thinking. I have spoken certain words worth speaking. Now, I shall try to explain this phenomenon in the light of a very interesting, famous story from one of our classics. It comes in the Bhagavata Purana. It is called Ajamila Ubakhyana, means the narration, description of the story of a person, a spiritual seeker. His name is Ajamila. Don't worry about the name, of course. You can read the book translation, Bhagavata Purana. This man was born in a good family. His parents brought him up. He was very obedient. He was a role model of a son. But in later years, when he became a young man, he fell into bad ways. He became a drunkard, a drug addict, a profligate, and a tormentor to his own parents. So he brought indescribable miseries to his own parents, his own relatives, all the people in the neighborhood. And this man now is about to die. He doesn't have much to you know, he won't dare to plead or pray to his own mind to go back because he doesn't have many wonderful things to remember. So he was totally helpless. Then he called to his side his son, whom he had deserted long back. The son's name was Narayana. That's one of the synonyms of a Hindu deity, Vishnu. It also means Narayanam Ayanam Gati, means the ultimate spiritual destination of human existence. That's the meaning of this particular name. So he called his son. He didn't have this meaning in his mind. He was helpless because he found demons are coming in search of him to take him to hell. So he was frightened, scared. So he called out, cried out. And the only person, only name, only relative's name he could remember was his own eldest son. And that name, the name of the eldest son happened to be Narayana, which also incidentally is a synonym of one of Hindu deities. And as he called the name of his eldest son, the demon's agents ran away from him. The reason was, that was the name that he was uttering as a mantra. When he was a youngster, every day he used to get up in the morning. He was, as I mentioned earlier, he was a very obedient son as a young boy. He used to take bath in cold water. He used to utter this sacred mantra with a sense of sanctity and sacredness and to pray to this deity. But that, those long back, he had a big deviation. He had become a drunkard and a profligate, and he had become a tormentor of his own parents. But still, in a helpless moment, he called out to his own son, who came rushing to him. But then his mind played another trick, and that was for his good. He also remembered that was the very name, the word he was uttering as a mantra. So his mind went back to his early days when he used to do spiritual practices, prayer and meditation, uttering the same mantra. And then it was taken to heaven. That's the story. Anyway, the whole point is, when you recite a divine word with a full focus and concentration on the implication of that word becomes a spiritual mechanism in your own system, and it goes very deep and it takes you to your spiritual destiny. In the science of mantra, there are four levels in which this happens. Already mentioned, when you utter a mantra, you concentrate on the meaning of the mantra. These four levels are from a descending order, para, pasyandi, madhyama, vaikari. These are four levels. When you hear a word loudly, or you may listen to, you may utter, that is the grossest form of spiritual practice of mantra shastra, mantra practice. When you also in any prayer, you do loudly, it is okay, but it is the beginning. The highest is when you reach a point of union, when you merge yourself with the essence or the deeper spiritual implication of that mantra, that's the highest. Between these two, there are two intermediary levels. So, Vaikari is the grossest. We are hearing many words. Many words are not so very desirable words. So, also hear some good words. And then try to focus on hearing only good words. If we can't utter a mantra with a sense of sanctity and sacredness and focus and concentration, then you use a big amplifier and let good, noble words fall on your ears so you can't run away from it. That is the beginning of spiritual practice. The highest is, after long years of practice, when you reach the experience level, the mystical level, when the mind merges with the essence of that mantra. This is highest. Between these two, there are two levels. That is Madhyama and Pashyanti. These are two levels. So you have to remember once more, at the lowest level, loud uttering of mantras. Next level, you utter but without making a lot of noise. As we evolve higher and higher, further and further, our spiritual practice becomes more and more subtle. As we mentally approach the essence of meaning of the mantra, we become less vocal, we become more deep, much deeper, and we can even utter the mantra even without making much noise. Lips may be moving. So this is called Upamsu in another tradition. The first one is loud vachika or verbal. At the next level, where you may not hear the voice, but your lips are moving. And the third level, where you are able to concentrate on the essence of the mantra, even in silence, at the highest level, you merge yourself with the essence of that mantra. Okay, now I know that some of you may think that this is some kind of a Hindu Vedantic tradition. I can give one example. Most probably, the example I can give is mostly from Russian Orthodox tradition. You hear this in Philokalia and all that. In the well-known 19th century Russian spiritual classic, The Way of a Pilgrim, the pilgrim happened to go to a church and he listened to a sermon. And the sermon was on the first epistle of St. Paul, in which St. Paul says, pray unceasingly, or pray without ceasing. That's prayer that he heard, but did not know what it actually implies. Anyway, he was impressed by this. Then what happened? He went in search of somebody who could teach him this. So he could contact a Russian Orthodox monk who took him to a cell, who taught him this, all Lord Jesus, save me, and I'm a sinner, that's what is famous as Jesus prayer, which most of you may be familiar with, so I need not explain that. It's called Jesus prayer. It is a prayer anyone can utter, but how to make this prayer unceasing, as an unceasing, a continuous, how to remain in a spontaneous, natural, continuous state of prayerfulness. That state is called in Vedantic tradition, it is called para, where your mind merges with prayer. Or rather, it is a kind of union between your mind and the essence of the prayer. So prayer becomes a natural experience, a natural intimate communion with the essence of the prayer. So a mantra need not be a single word. Mantra can be a poem. It could be a sentence. How this happens, again, I can give another example. That's also in the light of a very interesting episode in the same classic. The story is that of a young little boy who was a devotee, who received a prayer and how he reached the experience level. So it comes in the Bhagavata Purana from 8th to 12th chapters of the fourth book, Skanda, it's called. A small boy. It's again the story of a boy. It's very interesting. These spiritual classics are full of ideal devotees who are little children or who are very ordinary common people. Because of their purity and intense practice, they reach the highest level of spiritual experience, mystical experience, as we call it. So the name was Dhruva. He was born in a disturbed family where his stepmother and also incidentally his father ill-treated him, and his mother told him, "So little boy, you are suffering in this home, but there is one solution. I don't want to go details of the family story. If you go to a forest, if you pray to God, your problems will be solved." So just imagine for your for the background, a family, it's a royal family, Uttanapa, the name of the father. He had two wives in those days, and elder wife's son was Dhruva. He was ill-treated by his stepmother and also by father. So he prayed to his mother, and the mother asked him, "Don't hate your father or stepmother. You go to a forest and you find this teacher and you pray to God, your problem will be solved." This is simple, this background. He goes to the goes in search of a guru, a teacher. As he was walking in the forest in search of a teacher, a guru, the great sage Narada appeared before him. So the old sage saw a little boy walking at a distance. So he was surprised. So he thought, "Oh, this is something very interesting." Then he came to the little boy and asked him, "Why you are wandering in this forest?" So the boy explained his story. And then Narada told him, Narada wanted to test him whether he is just a kind of childish prank, that he has left his palace. Somebody told him, "Go in search of a teacher, go to a forest and you will realize God." So he was not sure that the child was really serious. So when he asked this question, "Why, what's the matter, why are you wandering in the forest?" Boy told his story. Then Narada tried to test him. "Oh, you are a little boy of 5 years. You should not be wandering in the forest. How can you realize God? Even the great sages are meditating, doing spiritual practices for years. Even for them it's difficult. So you should go back to your palace and pray with your friends. That's, you are a little boy." Then Dhruva, the boy, told the sage, "Well, I won't go back to my home before I realize God. I happen to meet a guru, I realize God." Then Narada exclaimed, "Aho teja kshatriyanam." He was impressed with great admiration at the child's strong determination. And eventually the great sage gives him mantra, a sacred word. That's the story. And the little boy goes to a hermitage, which is empty, on the bank of a river. Every day he will take bath and he will take, he sit in meditation for long hours with great concentration. He will utter this mantra. On the first month, he ate only once a day. The second month, he thought he won't eat anything. He will eat only some nuts. Third month, he said, "No, I won't eat anything, I will drink only water." And the fourth month, water also he gave up. That's how the story goes. Anyway, that's not the main point here. And the sixth month, what happened, you know, he had become so emaciated. He had not eaten anything or drunk water for 2-3 months. He became so emaciated that he breathed in, he could not breathe out. In the, you know, breathing exercise is called antakumpaha. I mean, you retention within. That's how the story goes. He uttered the mantra. Eventually, he became so identified with this mantra. When he was uttering this mantra, he was focusing his mind on the sublime form of God. It's a picture of Vishnu, the deity, was explained to him by his guru, the teacher, Narada. So he focused his mind, uttering this mantra, imagining that the Lord is being seated in his heart, and started the spiritual practice. The sixth month, then form disappeared. Everything disappeared, and he could see the form outside of him. So on the sixth month, as a result of this intense practice, the form on which he was meditating, the form of God being seated in his heart, he could see that form outside his, and he opened his eyes, and then he could not speak anything. He became totally silent. And for your information, if you read the Way of a Pilgrim in Russian mystical tradition, when the pilgrim learned the Jesus prayer from the Russian Orthodox monk, when he realized the intensity of that practice, when he could remain in a state of natural meditation on the essence of that prayer as a mantra, he became silent. He was filled with joy and happiness. He felt great compassion for the whole humanity. He felt a kind of inner, inexplicable joy and tranquility and serenity. You find more or less the same ideas repeated in this ancient Bhagavata Purana. When Dhruva, the little boy, felt the Lord was a reality, God was a reality standing in front of him, he felt so much of joy and happiness. And there's a prayer that he uttered simultaneously. Yonta pravishya mama vacham imam prasuptam sanjeevayadi akila shakti dharasvadhamna anyamsya hasta charana sravanatvagadin prana namo bhagavade purushayirubhim. This is the famous prayer with which he begins a long prayer. O Lord, you are the all-pervading reality. You are sitting in my heart, giving life to my mind, my intellect, my senses, and my thoughts, and my actions, and my words. So the silent boy suddenly leaped with joy and uttered a long hymn. So you find the journey of a spiritual seeker following the path of mantra. That means first he uttered verbally, which is vachigam, it's called vaikari in Sanskrit language. And then as he evolved along his spiritual route, the mantra practice became more and more subtle, and his experience also took him to higher and higher levels of intimacy with the object of concentration. And finally, his mind merged with the Lord. So you find the journey of a spiritual seeker from gross to subtle. So mantra is a vehicle that helps you to start your spiritual journey. And a royal highway is open before you. But again, traveling in a highway, you have to follow the rules and regulations. Before we attempt or we begin this journey, we have to follow certain moral, ethical principles. Frequently, in modern times, there is a mistaken view You need a formal training, a professional training to be a driver, to be a professor, to be a barber, to be a cook or a gardener. But in spirituality, you don't need any training. Straight away, you can take a book and start. That's a very, very serious and very mistaken view. Mantra Shastra is called, Shastra means science. You can become a scientist, you can become a student of science only when you are qualified for it. Qualification means we must obtain the necessary intellectual equipments. To enter a medical school, you need some qualifications. To become a doctor, you have to go to a medical school. So also, in spiritual traditions also, there are certain moral, ethical, psychological qualifications. Before that, if we undertake this journey, there are dangers, there are risks, because many of these mantras invigorate, energize the nervous system, our intellectual and mental faculties. Before we are fully established in many of these disciplines, if we undertake this journey, then what happens, you know, the energy, the heat, and also the vigor which are produced by this practice could take us in the wrong directions. So that's an important point to remember. Mantra Shastra is the science of the sacred word. It is not something occult. It is not something that we learn from YouTube or internet and then start practicing and going crazy and taking medicines. Not that sort of thing. It is a regular, rational science. And science means it has its disciplines, rules and regulations. You are playing with your mind, which is a dangerous game actually. You can play with your body. You lift something very heavy and you may break your back and you can go to hospital. You can be cured. But if you disturb your mind, there is no real remedy. Now, in fact, psychological problems not induced by these spiritual practices can be remedied. But delusions and manic developments, manifestations of mania and depression, induced by spiritual practices cannot be remedied by psychiatric treatment. They can be remedied only through some counter practices. So that's a different science anyway. So when you talk about mantra in Vedantic tradition, the most sacred mantra historically from a Vedic tradition is Gayatri mantra, which we discussed some time back. It has got 24 syllables. It is also one of the most sublime meter in Sanskrit prosody. I already discussed this earlier, so I won't go into those details right now. Now we are entering some other very important topics. I mentioned earlier that there is an evolution taking place when we take to mantra spiritual practice. Now, you may have experienced this already. When you take to a new spiritual practice, at the beginning there is a conflict. Conflict means a secondary personality emerges in the system. When you begin the practice of meditation, for example, or any spiritual practice, there's a conflict. On the one hand, we want to continue this practice sincerely, honestly. We have a strong, intense desire to take to spiritual practice. That's one thing. On the other hand, our normal habits, our tendencies and impressions, which are part of our existing character, personality, creates some stumbling blocks, obstacles. So on the one hand, one half of our personality wants to undertake a spiritual journey for some higher values. On the other hand, our natural habits, tendencies, impressions, characteristics create some stumbling blocks. So in a way, it's a conflict between what we want to do and what our mind allows us or permits us to do. So this is called secondary personality. Incidentally, Carl Jung also speaks about secondary personality, but not in the spiritual sense. He also speaks about the secondary personality, very important principle, if and Jung. That's a different context. But in spiritual life, the secondary personality is what actually is trying to take us forward. But it is weak at that time. In fact, it manifests as a weak, inaudible voice. No, we must get up early in the morning. We must pray. I should not read this nasty, dirty, worthless literature. I must focus on something useful. Or maybe people with undesirable habits, tendencies, may try to stop drinking, taking drugs, and he wants to start a new life. So on the one hand, this secondary personality, which actually wants to take you forward, is weak. He speaks in a very low voice, inaudible. But the natural personality that we have been following for years is strong. But as you persist in mantra practice, the secondary personality becomes stronger and stronger. Now, proportionately, the other personality, which creates obstacles, becomes weaker and weaker, proportionately. So this is the natural evolution of any spiritual seeker who takes to mantra shastra. Now, how do we reinforce, strengthen the secondary personality? Through associations with people, fellow spiritual seekers, or feeding our mind with healthy, desirable ideas and thoughts, doing or practicing unselfishness. Through these activities, we will create a new wealth of vrittis, tendencies, and habits which reinforce, which spiritually enrich the secondary personality. And as the secondary personality, which wants to take you forward, becomes stronger and stronger, the conflicts also subside gradually. That's why in the whole range of Vedic literature, there are four important statements which are supposed to be the most fundamental mantras of Vedanta philosophy and Vedanta spiritual practice. Each of these statements is found in one of the four Vedas. So one statement is called, it's called Mahavakyam. So there is one Mahavakya which is in the form of an instruction called, it is called Upadesha Vakya. It comes in the Chandogya Upanishad, in the Samaveda. There is a long dialogue between a father who instructs his son and also disciple. Uttanapada is the name of the father, guru. Swedagedu is the name of the disciple and son. So he gives one instruction, then the son goes on asking for more clarifications. And finally, there are 8 repetitions, total 9 statements in the Upanishads. So that's the beginning of the journey. You listen to something, something noble. But that's, in fact, to be benefited by something that you hear, you should hear it with a sense of sanctity and sacredness. In fact, the effect of what we do in spiritual life is in direct proportion to the amount of saddha or the sense of sacredness and sanctity with which we accept it. That's true for all religious traditions. The difference between a person who becomes skeptical, doubtful, slightly mischievous within, but also reads a lot of spiritual literature, is the lack of sraddha, the sense of sacredness and sanctity. When you hear a great spiritual instruction with a sense of humility, sacredness, and sanctity, then that instruction directly sinks in. It produces an effect. So tattvamasi is called upadeshavakyam. It means the statement of instruction. After listening to this statement, the meaning is this: the God you are searching, or the absolute reality you are searching everywhere, in temples, churches, synagogues, or anywhere, is actually within you. It is yourself, the Atman, or the divine, omnipresent reality, all-pervading spiritual reality, the absolute reality, God, whom you are searching, is actually within you as the immanent reality within. I mean, so the Uddalaka gives this instruction, the Atman that you are searching is you yourself. That's instruction. Now, this is just a word, you know, somebody tells you you are God, a very gross, dull-witted person will think, what an absolute crazy statement. I am a person who wears these clothes, he would eat lunch, breakfast, travels in a plane or a car. I am God. But so that's what a very primitive person will understand when he listens to this statement. But a highly evolved person who has a different definition, who gives a different definition, who looks upon himself as something beyond the psychophysical mechanism, he understands it better, he will find a higher meaning in it. So this process is called mananam, or nididhyasanam, anusandhana, means you are following the footsteps, one step after another, another step. Step by step, you are following, you are contemplating, and you are focusing and thinking deeply on the implication of this particular statement. There are two Mahavakyas which imply this stage, the intermediary stage of following, contemplation, meditation, or mananam. It is called Prajnanam Brahma and Ayamatma Brahma. Prajnanam Brahma comes in the Rigveda, Ayamatma Brahma. It comes in the Atharveda, in the Mandukya Upanishad. So I'm not going to those things right now. The last stage is what the instruction becomes an experience. So when you listen to an instruction with a sense of sanctity, you may not fully understand it. It's just a word. So the word should become an experience. Otherwise, just a word. So for that, to transform word into an experience, to make it a spiritual consciousness within, we have to do a lot of spiritual practices. It is called anusandhanam or siddhanta. I mean, you're going on focusing, contemplating, thinking deeply of the meaning of the instruction. And then as a result of this, it becomes an experience. It's called Aham Brahmasmi. It comes in the Yajurveda. So there are four great statements in the four Vedas, and they are found in the four Upanishads. So the journey from an instruction to an experience, a journey from word to consciousness. Now, that's how a word, a mantra, becomes a guide, a teacher, a protector, a preserver. So it takes you all the way from instruction to experience. Now, when we utter this mantra, Mantra Shastra tells you, your senses, your mind, your intellect become vigorous and pure. It's called Vritti Suddhi, it is called. Purification of tendencies, impressions. Vrittis, you know, human tendencies, are normally divided into two fundamental categories, positive and negative, called vikshipta vritti, normal human beings. As I mentioned earlier, there's always a conflict between what we want to do and what our mind allows us to do. Now we have to bridge this gap. How to bridge this gap? How to be able to do what we want to do? Gradual spiritual practices, prayers and meditations produce new vrittis, new tendencies. And when new tendencies are created, what we want to do is linked to, bridged to what our mind permits us to do. Finally, the mind and intellect merge into one. This is called vritti shuddhi state. But all vrittis become purified, become one positive, helpful vritti. So in other words, mantra from repetition should transform into consciousness. Awareness called mantra chaitanyam, it is called. So when that happens, we feel that we are following a particular direction. It is, in a way, it is a kind of prayer. The only example, something equivalent to this that I so far came across in Christian mystical literature is in the Way of a Pilgrim, where the pilgrim actually follows the instruction of a monk. The monk, remember, the pilgrim heard this. He knew the Jesus prayer literally. He had memorized all this. But it had not become a prayer so far as he was concerned. It was just a word. Anyone can read the Bible, the first epistle of St. Paul. It doesn't take you anywhere. That word should become a mantra. It becomes a mantra when it becomes sacred, when it becomes a potent, a spiritually potent, a spiritually effulgent, a spiritually conscious inner mechanism. Now there is something else that will happen. Why do we go to sacred places, temples, churches, so places associated with great sages and saints? Many of all traditions have got their own concepts of pilgrimages, their own idea of making pilgrimages to distant places, apparently associated with some holy personalities or holy associations. Why do places become holy? Why do temples and churches or synagogues or Buddhist temples become sacred? Because when great sages or great spiritual seekers who have practiced this mantra for a long time, years or decades of practice, when they have realized the spiritual potency of these sacred words, when they go to a place and when they utter these mantras, those places are filled with these holy vibrations. These vibrations remain there even long after they leave that place. So if you are a spiritually inclined person, and if you go to a holy place, though you may not have fully realized the spiritual potency of the mantra, or you have not reached the goal, spiritual destination, still, when you go to such a place, if you are a spiritually oriented person, you will be benefited by that. I can tell you one instance, and there's something that happened right in San Francisco, in this choir mind. Some years back, maybe about 20 years back, 15, 20 years back, one gentleman who was, you know, he was very sorry that his son had become a monk in the Vedanta Society. What a terrible tragedy. He has become a heathen. You know, he was a rabid, a totally rabid, uncompromising Christian evangelist. But his son became a monk. So he was very sorry. What a terrible tragedy. This fellow has become a monk and he came to old temple. And I heard from some of our own close devotees and monks, when the gentleman stayed in the old temple, he was certainly not a Vedantin. He did not know anything about Hinduism or Vedanta. He did not want to know anything about Vedanta or Hinduism. But that person felt, when I'm here, I feel like praying. That's the statement that he made. He had faith in his own tradition, in his own limited tradition. But when he went to the old temple, where the disciples of Sri Ramakrishna lived and prayed and worshipped and preached, the vibrations in the temple made him feel, well, I feel like praying here. Now, how does it happen? Because a building, a room, or a place accumulates spiritual vibrations, spiritual potencies. When you go to that place, even if you are at least some spiritual sensitivity, you will be benefited, you will be prompted. Your tradition may be different. You know, at the spiritual level, humanity is one. All religions are one. Only at the lower conventional levels, at the level of external practices, there may be differences. Human mind responds to spirituality in a very universal, very identical way. There is no difference. So any person who has prayed to his idea of God sincerely, anytime, will feel like praying to his God when he goes to a place which may not be a holy place of his tradition, because spiritual sensitivity is universal, it is scientific, it is the same for all. So that's how places accumulate spiritual vibrations. And that is the mystery of pilgrim centers. So one of our great devotional classics declare, Tirthi Kurvandi Tirthani. What it means is, great sages, when they go to a place, when they sit and pray and meditate, those places generate, those places accumulate those spiritual vibrations, which will remain there and which will benefit others who may come there. Maybe after thousands of years, you may go there, but still you can feel the spiritual vibrations prevalent. So this is a very, very common thing. That's why I mentioned earlier, at the spiritual level, at the highest para level of the mantra artha, that is mantra sadhana, when you practice mantra, and when you reach the highest level of total identification with the essence of what that mantra implies, at that experience level, all religious traditions are universal, identical, and similar, and the same. I should conclude this with another very interesting, very illustrative description of this spiritual journey through mantra from one of our Upanishads called the Mundaka Upanishad. So there is a very interesting imagery in the Mundaka Upanishad. The story is an imagery of two birds, the same tree. Think of one tree, two branches, one above, the other below. There is a bird sitting on the branch above, and there is a bird of the same family, the same species, sitting below. They have the same color, they look identical, they look similar, they look alike. But there is one difference. The bird sitting above, it sits quiet. It is perfectly in a state of total contemplation, contentment, serenity, and tranquility. Dua suparna savija sakhaya samanam vriksham parishusvajade tayor anya piplam swadatti anasnan anyu abhichapa sidi. This is the mantra in the Munduka Upanishad. So two birds, Suparna, Sayuja, Sakaya, they're friends. They look alike. They got the same wings, same color, everything same. But there's one great difference. The bird sitting on the branch above is sitting quiet in a state of perfect tranquility and peace and contentment. It doesn't do anything. But the bird sitting on the branch below, it is eating fruits. Some fruits are very bitter. When it eats the bitter fruits, it becomes unhappy. And some fruits are very sweet. When it eats the sweet fruits, it becomes very happy. So the bird sitting below corresponds to the human life or the predicament of ordinary human life. We become happy, and next moment we become unhappy. So there is always this conflict between what we want to do and what our mind permits us to do. It wants to stop eating fruits, then it can avoid the possibility of eating bitter fruits. Both the fruits look alike from the external appearance. So that if you want to stop eating bitter fruit, you should stop eating fruits altogether. You should give up the desire to eat sweet fruits. If you want to stop being unhappy, then you should give up the desire to be happy all the time. So when the bird looked above, it saw that the bird sitting on the branch above is always happy, always serene, always in a state of deep inner contentment. So as it started moving forward, upward, one branch above the other, slowly the apparent dissimilarity with regard to eating fruits disappeared. When he reached the top branch, the lower bird merged with the bird sitting on the branch above. So when we start our spiritual journey, with the help of a mantra, we are getting a glimpse into the real nature, into our own real nature. Because when the bird sitting on the branch below slowly reached the branch above, then he suddenly realized, I am not different from this bird. It is always contented. It's always happy. Because it doesn't seek happiness, it's always happy. It doesn't eat any fruits. So desires for sensual enjoyments, desire for happiness makes us frequently unhappy. So when the birds reach the top branch, you realize it is not actually different from the other birds sitting quiet. So when we reach our spiritual journey, we suddenly realize there is a higher me, there is a higher possibility, a spiritual possibility for me that I can attain. And this mantra is the path that takes us to the realization of this higher personality. At the beginning of spiritual life, the secondary personality that emerges when you take to spiritual life may be weak, the sounds may be inaudible, but as we go further and further, it becomes stronger and the sound becomes more and more audible. And our own reality becomes more and more visible, and we reach our spiritual destination. So this is the first, this is the first of the series of lectures on the science of sacred words. So I will try to elaborate further in the next week, in the next session. Thank you. Om Shanti, Shanti. Shantihi Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Pranamastu.